The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. How many of us have had these moments? You're having a nice family meal and you look over at one of the older children, their head is down, looking in their lap as they type out a quick text. Or you're just finishing up one last email to get a head start on work the next day when you feel an insistent tug on your leg as your child is trying to get your attention. Technology is ubiquitous for parents as well as children of increasingly younger ages. My guest writes that tech has altered our social discourse so rapidly, we've had no time to thoughtfully decide whether this is what we want. She advocates for what she calls a sustainable family, a family that understands how technology can overwhelm family social dynamics, that sets firm limits to technology use and balancing tech use with essential personal connections and communication. Clinical psychologist Catherine Steiner-Adair's new book is titled The Big Disconnect, Protecting Children and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. She's an instructor at the Harvard Medical School and an associate psychologist at McLean Hospital, who interviewed over 1,000 children from ages 4 to 18 to understand technology's less desirable effects on interpersonal relationships, childhood development, and family dynamics. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Catherine Steiner-Adair, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Throughout your book, The Big Disconnect, you share experiences from your practice that demonstrate the huge influence technology is having on childhood development and family dynamics. At what point did you say, you know, after seeing this in your practice, you said, I've got to write a book about this?
Well, I started thinking about it about 8 years ago. Then at about 5 years ago, I thought, you know what, this is really concerning me, and I really do want to write a book about this, and I need to get out there in the trenches and interview a lot of people and kids and really make sure I'm talking about something that isn't just particular to what I'm seeing in the schools I work in the country and the families and kids I work with in my private practice.
Were you seeing themes that showed up in your practice that you wanted to write about?
Yes. As a family therapist, a couples therapist, an individual therapist, what I saw was that technology in a way amplifies drama. And rather than connecting people in good ways, it takes very important emotional, psychological, human moments and creates more of a disconnect than a connect. Because it's a horrible thing to have a fight through a text war or to say something wonderful or something not so wonderful. Even the word sorry, you know, as a therapist, somebody would come in and say, well, what do you think he means? What do you think she means? And it would be the text, sorry. And I didn't know whether it was sorry or, you know, sarcastic, heartfelt, funny. So it really began to dawn on me that we are losing essential ways of connecting, especially when we take text and eliminate the tone of voice.
Well, certainly, you know, the way your eyes look when you state something to somebody, the nonverbal cues that are part of communication are completely lost in the cyber world. And it oftentimes leads to misunderstandings. How important does that go when you get into family situations and, more importantly, childhood development?
Well, families are now the primary language lab, if you will, for children learning how to be articulate about their emotions and how to express them and how to listen and be patient and listen and hear another opinion. And as soon as kids start texting and dealing with their relationship issues through text, there's a whole different form of communication that sometimes can be effective, but often is less effective than voice-to-voice, person-to-person. And we can't replace with technology things that are essentially human.
In your book, The Big Disconnect, the subtitle is Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. And when we hear that, we think, okay, this is going to be a book about how we need to keep our kids to put limits on the use of technology. But what I was interested to see, this is not just a problem of children and technology. Increasingly, children are reporting that they have to vie with their parents' technology for attention. That was really interesting to me. And how this is not just a situation of the children having too much technology, but oftentimes the parents turning to technology for those tedious moments in parenting and not being physically present for their children.
You know, one of the most moving things to me in doing the research when I interviewed 1,000 kids around the country between the ages of 4 and 18 and some college kids and young adults, is that each stage, children, whether they were 4 or 8 or 14 or 24, talked about feeling bad or sad or mad that they had to compete with screens for their parents' attention. And there is a sense in some children I interviewed of really kind of giving up on getting their parents' attention when they need it. They see their dads or their moms plugged into their email. They can't get them to pay attention to them, so then kids turn to their own laptops or screens or TVs. And in a way, turn to tech in those moments when they really needed was parents.
Mm. And this ties into one of the least desirable effects of technology on the family dynamics, which is that peers oftentimes become more important than family. Now, at some point in childhood development, that happens. Peers, right. You know, when you're a teenager, peers do become as important, sometimes more important for a period of time than the family. But what you see with technology is that happens far earlier.
You know, once you give an elementary school or middle school child the capacity to text and you pull up the car at carpool, you're going to lose being the person that they tell the story of their day to. And they're going to sit in the car and text with the kid sitting next to them or a child in another car. So while we give these devices to our kids thinking, oh, we're going to be able to be closer because we can contact them at any time, what kids do at an ever earlier age with phones and texting is they start texting their peers instead of talking to their parents. And children and parents are missing out on vital little mini conversations. You know, it's those carpool chats like what happened at recess today, and then you sort of talk it through with your child that parents are now missing out on.
A lot of times it's the kids may be talking about themselves, but you as in the front seat with your ears glued sort of pick up what's going on.
Absolutely. I was that mom with a big mommy van, you know, who drove carpool all the time because that's how you get the weather report.
Right.
You know, that's how you find out sort of the little things that really affect your child's life that they may or may not tell you directly.
Early in the book, you go through some of the less desirable effects of technology and certainly that upsetting the family dynamics of putting peers on a level with family. And it goes both ways, from the kids using technology to sort of tune out of the family to parents doing the same for the children. But certainly one that's often talked about, and this is the one that gets probably one of the most attention, is the loss of childhood innocence. And that means inappropriate images, whether it be violent video games or sexual content, or just those things that used to happen on the back of the bus with a picture, or maybe, you know, now it becomes cyber and it's far greater than it ever was on the back of the bus years ago.
That's right. And you don't have to sit in the back of the bus to access it. You know, now it's every kid who has unfettered access to the internet can completely unintentionally end up seeing things that they're just not ready to see. One quick story that comes to mind was two girls, a 10-year-old girl, a rising fifth grader, and a 12-year-old girl in middle school were hanging out at after school. And these girls are friends, and they really care about each other. And there was absolutely nothing malintended in this exchange that happened. The 12-year-old girl was looking at a trailer on her smartphone for a scary Halloween movie, and she's sort of the youngest of a bunch of kids in a family and had been exposed to a lot of stuff and thought this trailer was just hilarious and showed it to the 10-year-old girl, and it was a very gruesome, sexually sadistic overtones, very malevolent, very creepy trailer. And the 10-year-old girl was so upset by it that she could not stop crying for about 2.5 days.
Wow.
And she and her mom both, you know, said that she felt like her childhood was ended because she saw things that she couldn't handle, and they were so scary. And she had that reaction that, you know, many people have, which is she got frozen in the screen and looked at it over and over and over.
Now, it's interesting. That sort of goes along with one of the next points you make, is that technology has a sense of making us less empathic. And this is something that technology tends to lose with us because internet, anonymous comments, it can be snark, it can be tough, it can be sarcastic. And we lose a sense of empathy at
times.
Well,
we do, you know, and there's enough research now to show that when you are playing a very aggressive, violent video game, the part of your brain that has the capacity to plug in with empathy is pretty dormant. It's not completely flattened. But even in, you know, the snarky kind of repartee that goes on social networking sites, when you can quickly send something where you don't see visually the impact of what you are saying on the other person, we're less likely to be empathic. And there's a whole ethos in some of the social networking sites. Not all of them. Some are quite wonderful, but some are not so wonderful. And the ethos on some sites is it's kind of cool to be cool, and it's cool to be edgy, and it's cool to shock somebody and sort of push the limits. Let's see how far we can go, whether it's with a photo that's sexually edgy or using language that's edgy. But there's sort of this shock and awe dynamic that tweens and teens get into when they're just goofing around. But that goofing around on one end, when it's received on the other end, can be a pretty devastating experience.
And, of course, one of the other less desirable effects, which I think a lot of people see these days, is the art of conversation. When you're texting, I was struck by something somebody read that said, texting is a protective form. The art of conversation means you're actually open there. You're reacting instantaneously to what people say. Text gives you time to think about it. It gives you time to construct an answer. And in some ways, it's protective of your inner feelings and you know, your inner thoughts.
It's true. And for some kids, teens especially, they prefer to text because they can either calm themselves down or think of something wittier or even edgier than they might have spontaneously. You know, it's the effect of sort of having that shower when you think about all the things you wish you had said. But on the flip side of that, there, you know, certain teachers and parents and grandparents I've spoken with feel like children now have lost the art of conversation, or they answer monosyllabically, or they'll sort of stare at you quietly and not respond. And, you know, we lose a lot when we shift our main way of reaching out to people to a text which lacks human tone of voice.
Hmm. One of the things your book does is sort of take us through the various stages of development in childhood. And, of course, you, one of the things you write is that, you know, parents are just as guilty as overusing tech as children can be. And it's real important for us. And I think in the very first couple of years, you write that Joanne Deek, a developmental psychologist, said this should be a tech-free zone, infancy and toddlerhood. And you write about how, you know, baby parent time, the very beginnings, it's so important that the baby has the parent's complete attention. How does tech intrude?
Well, you know, when you think about what's the first thing you learn to do for your infant, you learn how to read their signals, and most of all, how to soothe them, how to calm themselves down, because we're just a little bundle of nerves when we're born. So we swaddle our babies, we coo to them, we sing to them. We begin to teach them that essential human tool of self-soothing. And when I see a mom or a dad hand a baby a smartphone at 18 months or 2 years old or whatever age it is, or an iPad, when they are fussy and upset, basically what you're doing is instead of calming a baby down and helping them learn how to calm themselves down, you are teaching them that stimulation is the way to deal with frustration and being upset. So it's that fast-paced pings and whistle, the lights of the iPad. And neurologically, that lights up a very different part of the brain than the lullaby wordplay kinds of games, you know, you play with your kids when you're standing in the checkout line. And every time parents turn to a screen and technology, moments of transition, going to bed, when kids are bored, when they don't, quote, know what to do, you're teaching them, basically, just go to the screen. Let the screen entertain you. Let the fast pace entertain you. Think quickly. Go to the next thing. Don't be bored. So we're really shaping our brains in ways we don't completely understand yet.
I was struck by something where somebody was doing research, and they could see babies sort of, you know, this is pre-speaking at this point, where when a parent turns away to an email or a tablet, they can see the parent disengage and they reflect that.
Yes. It's amazing. Some of the wonders of technology is we can now understand how the brain reacts and interacts with different forms of communication. And we know that by 4 months old, the baby knows whether it is its mother's voice speaking to them in real life or a voice through a TV screen. And babies respond so much better and more of their brain engages when they are being spoken to in real life. And it's very hard because now parents are being bombarded by a lot of very serious false advertising. This baby app will make your infant brilliant, teach your infant to read by the age of 2. And Susan Lin at the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood is actually filing complaints to the FTC against some of this false marketing, because just like the Baby Einstein product that Disney had to recall, not only is this untrue and certainly not based on any evidence, it can be harmful.
Getting back to what Joanne Deek said, tech-free infancy and toddlerhood.
Yes.
Is that for both parents and children?
Certainly for children. And, you know, I think parents really need to think a lot about what it's like to be 3, 4, or 5 and what children need from you. Children at 4 and 5 are very articulate about hating mommy's stupid computer, hating daddy's stupid computer, because dad said he was going to play with us at the beach or on vacation, but he brings his computer. Or it's bedtime, and they're trying to get their parents to put them to bed because they're tired and cranky. And they get the cranky voice parent saying, honey, this is important. It's for work. I'll be right there. I'll be right there. And the thing about technology is that when, as grown-ups, we're on our screens, we don't disengage in the same kinder or more gentle way than we do, say, if you're scrambling eggs at the counter making breakfast and your child interrupts you. You're more likely to be more empathic. Technology, especially when we're checking email, taps into the to-do list in our brain, and we just want to get one more thing done and one more thing done. It actually gives us like a dopamine hit in that part of our brain. And when that is interrupted, most people get cranky. So 3, 4, or 5-year-olds need their parents to respond to them, engage with them in a not-so-cranky way, and they certainly need to be playing dress-up with real dress-up, not click red tiara, click green tiara.
Well, once they get to elementary school age, oftentimes technology is a part of their life. Is it best to delay that as long as possible?
You know, we know that technology can help with certain skill drilling type things, and that kids are going to need to be introduced to technology pretty early on because this is going to be part of their learning. But it's very interesting. We are still learning so much about what are the better uses of technology in the classroom. And some schools that go one-to-one early are now peeling back and saying maybe we went one-to-one too early, a laptop for every child. But I think there are certain kinds of learning that really can be facilitated through technology. But there are also kinds of learning that absolutely are accomplished better through good old-fashioned and more creative, non-technological methods.
My guest today is Catherine Steiner-Adair, a clinical psychologist instructor at Harvard Medical School. She's the author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. It's published by HarperCollins. And it basically says, you know, put sensible limits on the use of technology. Keep it away from children for as long as you can. And be present when use your own technology, not when you're with your children. Spend time with your children. And you hopefully are trying to build what you call a sustainable family. What do you mean by sustainable family?
Well, I think that we have to spend more time thinking about how we create the foundations for family connection and family fun in a sense of family, and that family matters now in the digital age than we used to, because as we all know, a day can disappear, and we can all be on our screens and really not have had any meaningful interaction with each other. So sustainability, I think, is a concept I like because of, you know, obviously environmental awareness and concerns, but also it speaks to the idea that if you exploit a resource, you can damage it. And if you take for granted that your family is, quote, close or wonderfully connected because you text a lot, I worry that that kind of connection isn't really going to create the kinds of enduring family ties that people want to have, or the kinds of memories that children say they appreciate having, or the kinds of childhood family fun that kids say they long for. So I think that we need to think about what our family values are, what are going to be the times in our family where we're not going to use tech, how are we going to use tech. I think it's essential for families to still play together and make sure they play together offline. And, you know, it could be fun to play a Wii game or Minecraft or whatever with a family, but it's also very important that families do the kind of playing and interacting that occurs offline when you're all co-creating the play.
Yeah, I was really struck by, you know, I've had other people come on the show and talk about this, the idea that, you know, a lot of times technology is overwhelming a type of play that we've always had in children, really since children were free to be children, which is, you know, really not all that long ago, unless you were
right.
Incredibly rich. But the idea of independent, self-generated, creative play. This is, you know, go outside, take a stick and play.
Right.
And that stick becomes all sorts of things, you know.
Absolutely.
And technology, you know, the stick can't compete with technology. Let's put it that way.
Well, it can if you make sure your kids hang out a lot with sticks and mud and, you know, just the great resources of nature and the outdoors. What happens so often is that the fast speed of certain games really appeals to a lot of kids. And the idea that you don't have to work through feeling bored, it will take you to the next level. It will give you new options. It will let you start over instantly. And we need to make sure our children know how to sustain themselves in play that is not technologically oriented, because that's really where some of the most creative, innovative, important discoveries occur. Look how Steve Jobs got started, you know?
Yeah. When they get to the teenage years, technology's all around them. Everybody's using them. I would think the argument goes, I got to have this because I'm so uncool if I don't.
Well, there's truth to that. There's absolute truth to that. But what kids are doing more and more, certainly in schools that are having these kinds of conversations, is that they're redefining what's cool online. And, you know, there are always going to be some percentage of kids who will be drawn to sort of the nastier stuff, but in schools I've gone in and worked with, kids really don't want to have to join a culture where it's cool to be mean and edgy or aggressive or gossipy, etc. And when given the opportunity to really reflect on who they are in real life versus some of their personas that they take on online, they realize there's a really big disconnect between how they are relating online to each other and how they're relating in real life. And as often happens, when you give teenagers the awareness and the choice to sort of create their own counterculture to some of the yuckier online culture stuff, they'll do it. So I'm pretty optimistic. I think we're just at a place and a time now of the wild, wild web being, you know, the wild, wild west. And, you know, we had no gun control originally. Now we have different kinds of gun control in this country. And I think, you know, there's an analogy there for the Internet.
Depends where you live.
I guess that's really true, isn't it?
but I want to pick up something you said just a moment ago, which has to do with schools. How are schools redefined? I mean, for a long time, technology meant, you know, that was a sign of school success. The more technology you had. And how are schools redefining the appropriate uses of technology in the school?
Well, you know, there's such a range, and it's actually pretty cool to me and very creative. You know, within New York City, you've got unbelievable schools. Some are all tech-based for kids for whom that is by far the most effective way to get them engaged in learning, and kids who have a real proclivity for learning code, for programming, for the really great creative stuff that you can do with technology. I think the issue isn't, you know, what's the right amount of technology. It's more what's the right kind of technology and for which child and at what age and what stage of development. We know that technology can bring kids who are on the autism spectrum into better relationships, more capabilities than we were able to just using person-to-person type therapies. So, you really have to look at your child and their age and their wiring and really just think about what they need to be learning and what all the different options are for learning. Technology is now a wonderful new one, but it certainly is not the only or necessarily the best one. It really depends.
Let's talk about limits for just a second. You know, for a long time, limits on television was popular. I don't know if people still limit television today or not. They probably should. What about the rest of the technology? Should there be limits around the house, around the family unit for using technology?
Well, I'm just going to put in a really strong plug here for limiting all screens, especially TV.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, computers have a whole lot more to offer kids than TV, because on computers, you can go into very deep, interest-based, educationally informed, wonderful programs. And those are much harder to find on television. So I would say that, you know, many families that give this thought do what they do with TV. They say no TV, no trash TV, no entertainment TV during, you know, Monday through Thursday, nights that you're going to have homework. And then there are very clear limits about how much and what kind of content you can view or play with on the weekends. And I think that it's very important that parents are aware that beginning around age 10, 11, or 12, when kids are online doing their homework, unless you are monitoring it or have controls or know what they're doing, chances are really high that when they're, quote, doing their homework, they're multi-screening. They're on homework, doing their homework, and they're also chatting, and they're also, you know, going to YouTube when someone says, check out this video, etc. And it has many implications, not the least of which is it takes much longer for kids to do their homework. They're not thinking as deeply because it's constantly interrupting. Multitasking is a myth. It's not a reality. It's split attention. And if you let your kids have their computers and phones in their room through the night, a lot of them are going to be sneaking on and online and texting and talking in their room during the night. So you really need to think about, should we collect our screens at bedtime, make sure everybody's off technology? We know that the ability to fall asleep is disrupted by the light of the screen. Melatonin needs a half hour at least off screen to fully develop. So there are all sorts of regulations and conversations and ultimately, I think, responsible use policies families need to come up with.
All right. The name of the book is The Big Disconnect. Catherine Steiner-Adair, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Clinical psychologist Catherine Steiner-Adair speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. It's published by HarperCollins. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.